My name is Ed Goldberg, squeaky chair and all, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Kat Richardson. Kat, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, is this the first time I've interviewed you, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure. Now, is it Rock, is the publisher?
Yes.
ROC.
ROC.
Like the legendary bird.
Indeed.
And the title of the book is Underground.
Yes, it is.
What shelf did they put you on in the bookstore?
They put it on the fantasy and science fiction shelf. I think that you could probably split the book in half and put it on the mystery shelf as well.
What do you think you write?
I think I write detective novels with ghosts.
That's what I think you write, too.
Yay.
Yeah. Well, you managed to succeed in my case, at least. This is the first of your books I've read, and Harper Blaine,
yes,
is your protagonist, and she apparently has a history with you already. You've written a book or two about her before, have you?
Yeah, this one is book three.
Okay. Before we get to talking about Harper Blaine, I want you to tell a little bit about the genre that you write in. We're in the midst now of a kind of resurgence of, I want to call it horror, because that's only because I lack the term for it. We have the Twilight series of young mm-hmm. adult novels about vampires. We're always having vampire stuff popping up at us at one time or another on TV or in the movies. We have the zombie thing going on in the movies. We have a horror show on regular network television now, which isn't bad. Are we having a horror resurgence in the 21st century?
I think it's not so much a resurgence of horror as a crossover from horror to other genres that are a little broader accepted. Technically, they call what I do urban fantasy, and so it is shelved in fantasy and not in horror, except at people like Powell's, who have a longer history with horror. Mostly, it's the darker elements of fantasy being melded with other genre that are more recognizable, like romance, adventure, and mystery, principally. There's a couple of outliers, but that's mostly what it is. Hmm. And I'm not sure, as I said, it's not necessarily a resurgence. It's kind of a retooling and then adding it on.
Yeah, for some reason, romance novels and vampires have gone together for a while. I think that was probably the first crossover, because there's something romantic about some guy who's 400 years old and not quite dead biting holes in your neck.
I blame Chelsea Quinn Yarborough and Anne Rice for that.
Maybe.
Yeah, back in the 70s, I believe it was, when Rice came out with Interview with the Vampire, suddenly vampires became sexy. Although Chelsea Quinn Yarborough and her St. Germain series predated her by a little. And they're basically historical romances with vampire. Romance con vampire, I guess. Mm-hmm. They're pretty good, but they're quite old now. I don't think she's come out with one in a while. And I think that started the trend towards making the monster sexy instead of making the monster horrible. Although there have been vampire novels in the past, all the way back to Le Fanu, mm-hmm. which were kind of on the sexy side. There's always been a certain assumption that there is something sexy about being held down by someone who wants to nibble on your neck.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Even in the classic Bela Lugosi film, Lugosi looked like a Romanian pimp. He was, you know, not the best looking guy in the world. You know, he had 2 pounds of grease on his hair, but there was always the female vampires around. And in the book by Bram Stoker, there was a sexual power that vampires have over people.
Very much so. And of course, Stoker was also writing at a time when there had been quite a bit of sexual repression. So if you could put it into a context that wasn't directly sex, you could get past it and slide it past the moral censors of the time. Also, he worked in theater, so he knew that you could cloak a kind of sexy and exciting idea in something that was horrifying, oh no, and get away with it.
Yeah, there was the whole gothic thing in literature in those days as well.
Very
so
much.
That was all going on. What got you interested in this? Why don't you write, you know, forgive me for asking, but, you know, straight crime novels, detective novels?
Oh, partially because I'm a little bit on the lazy side.
Define that. What do you mean by lazy in this case?
I felt that to write a really good straight crime novel, I would have to do a lot more research and less winging it. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, my perception. Maybe I'm wrong. I've certainly seen a lot of winging since then. But I didn't come up with an idea that hadn't been done to death. I was all my early stuff was very hackneyed. It was very much the cliche. And I was a big, and still am, a huge fan of the hard-boiled school, people like Chandler, Hammett, Cornell Woolrich,
Cade. The usual suspects.
Yeah, the usual suspects, indeed.
Yeah.
And so that idea was kind of in my head, that sort of hard-boiled stuff. And I thought, I can't write this. A, I'm a girl. And B, I just don't know how. So I went off in a weird direction where I thought I could meld two things together and get away with writing something that was a mix of the stuff I really loved and the stuff that I thought was kind of weird and funky. And I started a draft of it when I was in college, and oh my goodness, the stink that rose off of that draft could have driven people out of the room. Mm-hmm. It was that bad.
All of our first books are like that.
Yeah,
let's face it.
It was a trunk novel that somehow managed to crawl out of the trunk. It took 10 years from the time I wrote a sketch until I actually had a complete first draft in 2000. And then another 5 years to clean it up and get it published.
Mm-hmm.
And the first book came out October of 2006.
It titled?
It was called Greywalker, mm-hmm. and it was followed up August of 2007 with Poltergeist.
Now let's get to the Greywalker. Greywalker, this is an interesting concept. Is this something you came up with yourself?
Well, I thought I had. Since then, I've seen some other variations that are similar but not the same. As far as I know, I'm the only person writing this particular approach.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that there's kind of an interference zone between our world and whatever is beyond our world, be it the paranormal or just plain old-fashioned death. And I thought, well, what is that? If it's there, what's in it? How do you get there? Why don't we see it all the time? And I'd been reading a lot of particle and quantum physics at the time, reading stuff about energy states and how quantum physics starts to fade into metaphysics. And the ideas kind of all fell together on a very foggy day in downtown Seattle when I had the impression that you could turn a corner and see something that you wouldn't normally see outside of a nightmare because it was such a strange set of weather conditions. So all those things came together and I came up with this idea wherein the ghosts and the vampires and the magic are effectively a higher energy state, and only people who have special access through some kind of experience or some kind of oddity in their personality or their mind can access and see it.
Yeah, and just like you have one foot in the crime world and one foot in the horror world, Harper has one foot in this world and one foot in the next world.
Absolutely.
And what happened to her to give her this second sight?
Oh, she died for 2 minutes. She was clinically dead in an accident. Man she was investigating blew his top and threw her down an elevator shaft.
Ouch.
It wasn't a good moment, mm-hmm. No. Effectively, she got beaten to death, but she came back from it because she's a tough broad.
Mm-hmm.
And then she suddenly started seeing strange things, and she wasn't ready to accept it at first. She still has some problems with it. She doesn't like it, but she accepts what she is. She's just not always sure that it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, but not much you can do about it either.
No, and I took a little flack initially about how she resisted it, because a lot of the other books in the genre jump in with, oh, here you have a superpower, isn't it lovely? And I thought, no, if you've worked very hard to create a life that satisfies you in spite of people pushing you in other directions, and that's definitely Harper's case, and then someone rips it away from you, you're not going to be pleased. But hopefully, you march ahead and make the best of your new situation, and that's what I want Harper to do and what I hope I've been able to project.
There's, I do movie reviews, and so I've been a film fan for a long time, and one of the things that the Marx Brothers taught me a lesson, and that is no matter how bizarre they make their universe, if it's consistent within itself, you buy it.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That is if Harpo can pull a flaming blowtorch out from under his coat, you buy it because everything else around it seems to, you know, point toward that as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
How hard do you work to keep your universe consistent, or is that a consideration with you at all?
It's definitely a consideration. I maintain what I call the series Bible, and it has all kinds of information for me to keep track of. Where something happened, what it's related to, what it's building up to, why it happens, how it happens, what the limitations are, what I can and cannot do, what rules I can break later, but only if I set up how the rules can be broken in some previous book. I do try to be consistent because I think the worst thing in the world is cheating your reader by saying, oh, sorry about that. Yeah, I changed my mind.
Yeah, that's just like, I know it was all a dream.
Oh, that's the worst.
That's the worst, yes. That's what they tell you in writing one. Do not ever do that. When we meet Harper, she's cranky. She has a relationship that's starting to stink, and it's breaking up. Tell us about what's going on in her life.
Oh, at the beginning of book three, she has just come off an adventure which caused her an injury, so she's trying to rehabilitate it. She's also trying to rehabilitate this relationship, which started in book one. Unfortunately, the guy she's dating, much as she loves him, just cannot get his brain around not only her life as a detective, which is a little weird and threatening, but the fact that very strange things happen around her, and she's not very open to discussing what's going on in her life.
You almost can't blame the guy.
Well, no. He's really a good guy, and I feel bad about all the horrible things that end up happening to him over the course of the series. You know, she runs out on dinner I don't know how many times because something comes up. At one point, she gets arrested. She has to call in from the police station and say, sorry, I can't make it back for dinner. I'm in jail. You know, just awful things.
It's kind of stuff that guys usually do to women, you know?
Exactly, because she has this crazy life. So it's falling apart. She's doing her best. But in Underground, she does end up having to reveal some things that upset him beyond the pale. He simply can't live with it. And it's not that he's rejecting her. It's that he can't make his life fit around her needs, and she can't not do what she does.
Mm-hmm. And what introduces her to the current case? What gets the ball rolling here?
Well, she has a friend who's kind of an electronics whiz.
Quentin.
And his name is Quentin, yeah. He's kind of a mysterious guy. He doesn't seem to have a fixed address. He's sort of an oddball, but if it's electronic, he can fix it. And he comes along and he says, I want you to come and look at something in the train tunnel, which always sounds like a bad idea anyhow. So they walk down to the train tunnel, and there they find the body of a homeless man. And at first they think he's been run over by a train, and later they realize he can't possibly have been hit by a train. Something has gnawed his legs off and left him in the tunnel. And he says, well, this isn't the first one. There's a whole bunch of these over time, and I'm intimately involved with some of these people because I'm homeless myself, and I don't want to be framed for this. Please solve this problem. Something is eating homeless guys.
Before we go any further, I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Kat Richardson. Title of her book is Underground, published by ROC, R-O-C. Just to digress for a moment here,
sure.
One of my other favorite Seattle writers, G.M. Ford, you and he travel a lot of the same territory in Seattle.
Oh,
Pioneer
yeah.
Square, the area around Pioneer Square, the people of not the highest social status hanging around in Pioneer Square. Do you know Jerry? Was he sort of an inspiration to you?
I've met Jerry a couple of times, and he's a wonderful guy. He's very funny and very personable, although sometimes the books make you go, gee, Jerry, ugh. You
know? Oh, like people being chewed up by something.
Like people being chewed up by monsters, yeah. I think it's just, if you live in Seattle for any amount of time, you start to notice that Pioneer Square and environs are full of some very weird and occasionally ugly stories that a lot of people don't want to look at. They are the areas of town that tend to be economically depressed, and of course it's the old part of town, even though we've been trying to rehabilitate it. It's been literally Skid Road off and on throughout its existence. And there's always interest in the things that are buried and the things that are controversial and dirty and gritty. And I like grit and dirt and controversy, so that's why.
You're not exactly Mary Tyler Moore here, but I would hardly consider you gritty. I mean, that's not what I think of when I think of you.
Oh, well, thank you. I do bathe.
You mentioned the book, and you talked about not wanting to research, but it occurs to me there's quite a bit of research in this book.
Yeah, I fell into that because actually I have a degree in journalism with a minor in history, and I love history. And there's nothing that I think is more interesting than digging around in local, funky, weird history that everybody else has just kind of put to the side because, yeah, well, we all know that. Except after a while, you start to forget what we all know. And it becomes kind of this rote recitation. And what's really behind all of that is often the most interesting thing in the world to me. Mm-hmm. So I find myself digging into things like old newspaper archives and, in this case, the Underground Tour in Seattle and asking a lot of apparently very weird questions of people who've never had that question asked of them before.
Did you creep out the tour guide?
Actually, I had a lot of help from the head historian. His name is Rick Botel. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about things that you can't discuss on the tour because it's now PG rated, or at least PG-13. And some of the things that he can no longer discuss because it's a family show, went into the book. Mm-hmm. Things like the age of consent at the time of the Klondike Gold Rush was 10. And there was a lot of racial tension. There was a lot of ethnic division. It was just before the Chinese Exclusion Act. There's an awful lot of things going on that we have now forgotten about. And Rick gave me a lot of leads. He also provided a lot of photographic reference so that I knew what things had looked like. And they think it's the best book ever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm glad they like it. One of the reasons there's an underground is that the city was literally raised up at one point, mm-hmm. because, for one thing, the toilets didn't flush correctly. And every time there was a flood, the city got flooded out. True,
right,
yes,
the city
right?
of Seattle was built on a mud flat. And at high tide, the streets got very slushy. And then along came this fire, which turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to Seattle, because not only did toilets flush backward at high tide, since we had what they called a gravity-fed sewage system, which is to say pipes that went from houses to the Sound. And every time the tide came in, if you were fool enough to pull the chain on the toilet flushed up instead Ooh. Of down. So along came this fire, raised most of the central core to the ground, which they then bulldozed and built up these massive walls on either side of what would eventually be the street, filled it in with garbage, and then built sidewalks over the pits that remained between the street and the buildings. And that's really the origin of our underground city, is those sidewalks and building basements, sometimes 5 and 6 stories deep. They're only 1 to 2 in Pioneer Square, but as you head towards the bluff, they get deeper and deeper and deeper until you're walking around 3 to 5 stories under the street, if you can get in them. Most of them are not accessible.
Is there really a cemented-in comfort station down there?
Yes, there is. In fact, you can't get to it because of the cement. But yeah, there is a subterranean comfort station. In fact, it was the model for a rather famous one in Chicago, which you can get into now they've renovated it. If you ever want to see a subterranean comfort station, Chicago is the place to go.
They have everything in Chicago, don't they? One of the other things, you want to talk about Sistu?
Not especially.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, we'll back off on that. Let me abstract it one level here. One of the other things you apparently did some research in are Native American legends of the Northwest tribes of the Kwakiutl. And I guess I have to leave it to you how much you want to tell us, but tell us about what you were studying and what sort of things you wanted to use for the book.
Well, I really needed a monster. We called it the Monster in the Sewer book when we were first discussing it. I said, I want to write a Monster in the Sewer book. And everyone said, great, what monster are you going to use? And I thought and thought and I thought, the appropriate thing is a Native American monster, because, of course, the Native Americans of the Pacific Northwest are kind of overlooked, except for the totem poles, which are very, very famous.
And potlatches.
And potlatches, yeah. And people kind of forget that there is a whole culture there that is very rich and very interesting, and it's very cohesive. The entire Pacific Northwest is one big tribal group. It's all the Northwest Salish. And so they have a lot of stories in common and a lot of themes that recur, and I thought, well, what kind of monsters do they have? And I started looking into it, and I found this terrific monster, except he has a really goofy name. And when I first proposed this monster, my agent started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? And he said, you can't use that monster. People will laugh. It just has the goofiest name ever. And I said, I think I can make it scary. And my editor said the same thing. She was much more polite about it. But she said, yeah, it does kind of knock you out of the story. I mean, that's goofy. And I said, you wait and see. I'm going to make this goofy-sounding monster really scary.
You know what? That didn't occur to me at all. I mean, I read this and I didn't say, boy, this, how could it be scary with a silly name like that? That didn't even cross my mind.
Well, there is actually a discussion in the book
about
that, and it's largely an homage to my my agent and my editor, because they had given me such a hard time, and entirely, you know, in a good way. It turned out to be a really good thing, because they pointed something out to me, which I then minimized and made a point of tearing apart.
One of the things that happens to Harper as she's wandering around in the netherworlds is that she gets bumped by a zombie.
Oh.
Tell us about getting the bump by the zombie and what it resulted in. I want to know about those little threads, too.
The zombies. Yeah, it was suddenly there's a big spate of zombie books, and I hadn't really thought about it. I just thought, you know, if you've been wandering around eating people in the underground, you know, what kind of leftovers do you have? And these guys are the leftovers of, you know, sort of unfinished meals. You know, they're the refrigerated takeout doggy bags of, you know, the villainous creature. And they're kind of held together by this magical goop that it exudes. And eventually Harper has to figure out how to, you know, kind of take them apart so they can get the heck out of here and go on to the next plane, whatever that is. And it's a little bit disgusting. But I just thought, you know, you can't eat a meal without leftovers. So these were the leftovers.
That was pretty funny, actually. little threads, little gray threads. There's little threads of different colors everywhere in the story. But what's the significance of the threads in the zombie specifically?
Well, there's specifically a magical material that's exuded by the monster in order to keep his prey quiet until he gets around to eating it.
Like spider silk.
Yeah, like spider silk. Very similar.
That kind of disgusts Harper, among other things.
Oh, yuck,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes. But in the meanwhile, it turns out that after Mike gets up and leaves because he can no longer take this anymore, that I hope you don't mind me giving this away.
That Will, her boyfriend.
Will, I'm sorry. What did I come up with, Mike?
His younger brother is named Michael.
Okay, whatever. She starts to see something in Quentin that maybe she hadn't seen before.
Yeah, and, you know, that was one of those things that I hadn't really seen much of myself initially. I had put the character in because
he was... Did this pop up while you were writing it?
Well, it was something that I started to notice about the time I was developing book two, was that Quentin is an interesting guy, not just because he's got this kind of weird, mysterious past, which you learn a lot more about in Underground, but he kind of gets it a little bit more than all of the normal people, because he's kind of an abnormal weirdo himself. Also, he's a geek, being a techie sort of folks, and I thought, you know, it would be really nice to have this guy show up a little bit more, because he's fun. And then as it was fairly obvious that this relationship between the heroine and her boyfriend was falling apart, I thought, hey, there's got to be somebody else out there who isn't, you know, completely from outer space. Whoa, look, here's a really cool guy. I already put him in. I don't even have to invent him.
Yeah, I hope I'm not giving too much away here, but there's a photograph of him in an earlier life pops up wherein he's a pasty-faced, slightly overweight schlub.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I thought that was just, you know, ideal because I know so many people for whom the love interest or even the friend interest ends up being, you know, tall and good looking and, you know, fabulously well put together. And this guy's just kind of an ordinary guy like a lot of the guys I went to school with. You know, he likes to spend time with his electronics and his computer, and he can spend an awful lot of time. In fact, he's a lot like my husband in that, just kind of staring soulfully into his machines.
Ah, yes, the soul of the machine. Well, it doesn't mean, like, to paraphrase Nietzsche, if you stare into the machine, pretty soon the machine begins to stare back into you. Yeah. Why does Harper want to get involved in this? I mean, this is really, she doesn't really, as is usually the case with the protagonists in these books, it's always something pulling them away from the case. You know, the little voice in the back of the head saying, what the hell do you need this for? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. What impels her to get involved?
Well, she is a professional, and it's the job that she's always wanted and has worked towards for years, is to be a professional private investigator and run her own life her way. Also, she has a certain moral drive to do the right thing, especially where her friends are concerned or where anything is probably going to be just ignored by everybody else. It just gets up her nose to see things pushed to the side, marginalized, and to have people pretend it doesn't happen. She gets a little bit upset at one point in the book about a situation with the homeless, and she can't take it on right that minute, but you can bet that eventually she's going to deal with some of these problems that piss her off.
So down these mean subterranean streets, a woman must go who is herself not mean.
Yeah, pretty much.
We have a couple minutes left. What's next? What are you doing?
Well, I am under contract for 3 more books in this series for a total of 6. I'm working on book 4 right now. Mm-hmm. It'll be coming out next year under the title Vanished. And then 2 more beyond that. I've got a werewolf short story coming out in October in an anthology called Wolfsbane and Mistletoe. The headliner on that's Charlaine Harris, who is absolutely terrific. And in January, there's a Harper Blaine novella coming out through Rock. And, you know, that's a longer story, 25,000 words. the publisher decided to put it together because they wanted to put a bunch of us who were sort of difficult to type into one big book.
So you could be all ignored at once?
We could all... No, you can't be ignored because the headliner is Jim Butcher.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And the second headliner is Simon R. Green. And then there's me and a gentleman named Thomas Snegoski, whose first solo book just came out. He's also kind of an odd reader who came in from comic book side. He used to work a lot with Christopher Golden.
And so there's a lot of people writing it in this genre.
Yeah, and it's becoming a more divided genre. Originally, it kind of drifted over from romance and kind of wandered around not knowing what it was or where it was going. Now there's a lot more of this kind of dark, hard-boiled stuff going on, which I like, but it's nice to have a choice. So it runs from the very soft kind of romantic side to the very noir, where you start off in kind of a bad condition and things go downhill from there, mode. You can find almost anything there as long as you don't mind ghosts and vampires and werewolves and things that go bump in the night. Mm-hmm. You're pretty good to go.
Yeah, well, that is one of the things about horror movies and roller coasters is that presumably you can get thrills without putting your life in any serious danger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, isn't that what it's all about?
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Kat Richardson is the author of Underground, published by Rock, R-O-C. Please come back again for your next book.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
Oh, one more quick thing. I don't want to put you on the spot. Any movie nibbles?
There has been some sniffing around, but as with everything with Hollywood, you don't know until the fat lady sings.
That's right. Everything moves on its own pace. Yeah. Thanks again.
Thank you.